Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Steve Brown. Tonight we have a panel discussion titled To Have and Have Not, The Growing Economic and Social Divide and Its Implications for Educational Leaders. Speaking will be a distinguished panel of thought leaders who explore the impact of social and economic inequality on educational institutions and systems, the workforce, and society. We begin with an introduction of our guests by tonight's moderator, WBUR reporter Monica Brady-Myroff.
First of all, I want to introduce Richard Wilkinson. He has played a formative role in the international research on the social determinants of health and on the societal effects of income inequality. He studied economic history at the London School of Economics before training in epidemiology. He's a professor emeritus of social epidemiology at the University of Nottingham Medical School. He's honorary professor at University College London and a visiting professor at the University of York. That's a lot of institutions for one man. But if you've read his most recent book, The Spirit Level, you can see that he has a lot of great ideas to share. He wrote this with Kate Pickett, and it's a bestseller in the UK and several other European countries. It's now available in 20 languages. He's also the co-founder of the Equality Trust, and we'll hear more about The Spirit Level and the research in that book in just a moment. Sitting to his left is Barry Bluestone. Might be recognizable to you, many of you in this room. He's the Stearns Trustee Professor of Political Economy at the School of Public Policy and Urban Affairs at Northeastern University. He's the founding dean of that school. And as a political economist, Bluestone has written extensively in the areas of income distribution, business, labor, higher education, finance, and urban and regional economic development. He's the author of 10 books and has frequent appearances in the media and on WBUR, as has Mr. Wilkinson and Mr. McGuire. But most recently, in 2000, he published a book that also addresses this topic called Growing Prosperity, The Battle for Growth with Equity in the 21st Century. To his left might be a face not as familiar to Massachusetts residents, but it is the governor of Connecticut. We're pleased to have the Honorable Daniel Patrick Molloy. He is the youngest of eight children, and he was born in Stamford, Connecticut. Growing up, he brings a special perspective to today because growing up, Governor Molloy struggled to overcome learning and physical disabilities, eventually gaining the skills he needed to go on and graduate magna cum laude from Boston College and continue on to Boston College Law School. So he's a double eagle. Is that correct? Yeah? Okay. I was like, there's kind of silence. Did I get that wrong? No. Yeah, I got that right. Governor Molloy became prosecutor in New York first, and then he later returned to his hometown of Stamford, where he was mayor for 14 years, 1995 to 2009. And then in 2010, he went on to become governor of Connecticut, and he's the first governor to have been elected under the state's Clean Elections Program. To his left is Jack McGuire, chairman and founder of McGuire Associates. He holds a PhD in theoretical physics from Boston College and received a postdoctoral fellowship from Rice University. But as a scholar who was trained in the scientific method, he really introduced market research to the field of admissions. And he created the first enrollment management model. So this was something very new when he did this. And Jack recently co-authored a book on the systems approach to enrollment management called E equals MC squared, a new formula for enrollment management. He's also authored numerous papers and has also been featured in the media. And he serves on several boards, including the United Cerebral Palsy Association and the College Board. So we have a very distinguished panel here today, as you can hear. And we're going to start with Mr. Wilkinson first, laying out an overview of his research on social inequality.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here. Our book is sometimes called A Theory of Everything because we deal with mental illness and life expectancy and prison populations and violence and drugs and teenage birth rates and so on. It's not a theory of everything. It's a theory of problems which are more common at the bottom of the social ladder, in the most deprived areas. You know, the outcomes we look at are ones that have that social pattern. So although there's violence at the top of society, it's more common at the bottom. Although there's depression at the top, it's more common at the bottom, and so on. And you can look at those patterns, and you can imagine that maybe it's just a sorting out of the population. The resilient move up and the vulnerable move down, and that's why we have these social gradients. I'm going to show you that these problems are anything from twice as common to 10 times as common in societies with bigger income differences between rich and poor, which I think means that these sorts of problems are substantially responses to social status differentiation itself, responses to class differentiation. There are very rapid rises in life expectancy in the early stages of economic growth. And interestingly, as it levels out, you get the same pattern in if you look at measures of well-being or measures of happiness. And what it means is that we in the rich developed countries have largely got to the end of the real social benefits of economic growth. They are what's transformed the quality of our lives. Economic growth is. While it's still really important for people in poorer countries to have more of everything, for us to have more and more of everything makes less and less difference. Countries like Norway and the USA are twice as rich as countries like Israel, Greece, and Portugal. Currencies are converted to take account of prices, so people in those countries can buy twice as much of everything. And it makes no difference to life expectancy whatsoever. No suggestion of a relationship. And yet I hope you all know that health is just about always worst in our most deprived areas. And in the United States, you have social gradients in health like this. These are zip median incomes of zip code areas. The rich ones on the right with the lowest death rates, the poorest on the left with the highest death rates. And every country we look at, we see these social gradients. This isn't a these, by the way, are just white men. So it's not a difference between ethnic groups. It's not a difference between the poor and the rest of society. You have to be able to explain why the people just below the top are less healthy than ones at the top. So don't think just about unemployment or homelessness or people who run out of money for food before the next benefit check comes in. Those are important, but they're only a very small part of the extreme right-hand bar. You've got to have some other view to explain these things and to remember that these gradients... Well, I've shown you the contrast between how much income means within our societies and how little it means between our societies. That's a real paradox. And the explanation is that within our societies, we're looking at the effects of relative income or social status, social position, where we are in relation to each other. And as soon as you've got that idea, you should start thinking, what happens when we pull out those differences and make them bigger, the income differences bigger, or squash them up and make them smaller? What effect would that have? And that's really what I'm going to show you. When I talk about equality and inequality, I'm never talking about any non-existent extremes. I'm talking just about the scale of income differences as reported to the UN and World Bank, well, actually as measured by these organisations, in the different rich developed market democracies. This is not about communism and capitalism. All these are rich developed market democracies. The measure we've used, just because it's easily available from, as I say, the World Bank or UN, is how much richer the top 20% in each country than the bottom 20%. The top 20% is 3.5 or 4 times as rich as the bottom 20%. But in countries like the UK, Portugal, USA, Singapore, the differences are twice as big. Twice as much inequality as other rich developed market democracies. We collected internationally comparable data from the most widely respected sources like WHO, OECD. We also collect American government data, but this is life expectancy for each country, maths and literacy scores that you can get for kids, OECD puts them together, infant mortality rates, homicide rates, the proportion of the population in prison, teenage birth rates, how much people trust each other, obesity, mental illness, which in the standard psychiatric classification includes drug and alcohol addiction, and some figures on social mobility. There we've put them all together into one index, our index of health and social problems. They're all weighted equally, so where a country is a sort of average of all those things, influenced just as much by, trust as by maths and literacy scores or homicide rates. An extraordinarily clear tendency for the more unequal countries to do worse on that mix of problems that have these social gradients within our societies. We were worried because, you know, equality and inequality is a very politically hot potato, if you like, that people would think that we'd chosen outcomes that suited our argument. And you can see we've got most of the things you might expect to find internationally comparable data for that have social gradients. So we also looked at the UNICEF Index of Child Wellbeing. The UNICEF Index of Child Wellbeing is made up to measure well-being in rich countries of children. It has 40 different components. We had nothing to do with them, how they were put together, but it contains whether kids can talk to their parents, how they get on in these maths and literacy scores tests, what immunization rates are like, whether there's bullying in schools, whether kids have books at home. All that goes into it. And here it is in relation to that same measure of inequality. A very clear, highly significant tendency for the more unequal countries to do worse. I find this an embarrassing lecture to give to American audiences because the USA so often does worst of all these countries, but fortunately there's this one where the UK does significantly worse than the USA. But look at this same index in relation to national income per person. And again, you see, there's no relationship. We talk a lot about child poverty as the problem, without distinguishing between relative and absolute poverty. And the political messages are totally different. You know, if it's absolute poverty, then we want more incentives to industry, more economic growth to lift children out of poverty. That apparently won't do any good at all. What the figures tell us is that we have to close the gaps between us. What matters is how far behind the rest of us families with children are and how unequal the societies they're growing up in are. I want to take you through some of the separate outcomes that we've measured. This is trust. Levels of trust in the more unequal countries dropping as low as 15% of the population feel they can trust others, whereas in the more equal countries it's 60 or 65%. If you've got to walk home late at night in any of our major cities, you'd feel much safer in one of the more equal countries. This is mental illness. There are threefold differences in population levels of mental illness. This isn't just people going to their GP. This is WHO using the same diagnostic interviews on random samples of the population. And it goes from about 8% of the population with any mental illness to 26%. Threefold differences in whole populations, mainly anxiety and depression and things like that, but still. We've been through all sorts of outcomes, things to do with the quality of social relations, health and human capital. Basically, what we see, I think, confirms that intuition that people have always had, that inequality is divisive and socially corrosive. And it shows that intuition that people have had since before the French Revolution is truer than, certainly, than I ever imagined. I didn't think it would be worth looking at data in relation to the differences in inequality between these countries. I may say the differences I've been showing you are so large in these outcomes, anything from threefold to tenfold differences, because it's not just the poor who are affected by inequality. In your 25 more equal states, death rates are lower at every level of income, right across from the richest to the poorest. So given your level of income or education or your position in the occupational hierarchy, You do better if you're in a more equal society. The difference is that inequality makes a biggest at the bottom of society, but even near the top, there seem to be small benefits. Basically, the take-home message, I think, is that people would think this was a message about taxes and benefits. It's not necessarily. If you look at how well Sweden and Japan do in this, they both do well at the bottom left of this. They get their greater equality in quite different ways. Sweden has very large differences in income, and it closes the gap by high taxes and generous social welfare spending. Japan, very much the opposite. It starts off with smaller differences in pre-tax incomes. It has lower tax rates. It does less redistribution, has a smaller welfare state, but they both do equally well. And we find rather the same contrast in the United States. And New Hampshire does well, so does Vermont, but they do well in quite different ways. So we conclude that it doesn't matter how you get your greater equality as long as you get there somehow. But look, we're looking at a general social dysfunction related to inequality. The same countries do badly on all those different outcomes, and the same countries do well. But don't think that you can explain it by thinking of, cultural differences or whatever. Some of these relationships have been shown in so many other settings. There are about 200 papers in the academic journals, peer-reviewed, looking at health in relation to inequality in different societies. And so where our critics from the far right pick apart our data in the book, I want to show them a paper that shows that even the provinces of China that are more unequal have worse health. You know, what this is about is some fundamental human truth about the damage that inequality and social hierarchy do. And I think to understand it, one's got to think about our evolved sensitivity to social hierarchy. You have to start thinking about monkeys and so on. But I must stop there. You can get more either on our website or through the book. Thank you.
Thank you for bringing some light to the fundamental human truth, as you called it, about the health and social effects of inequality. Very, very interesting. Now we're going to turn to Professor Bluestone, and he's going to look at the reasons for this social inequality. And he says he can name 10 in at least under 10 minutes. But come on up, please.
First of all, thank you, Richard, for a brilliant introduction to our subject tonight. I want to give you, first of all, just some brief statistics and then tell you how we might explain them. If you look at the period after World War II here in the United States, from 1947 through 1973, we actually went through a period of time in which inequality declined. We became a more equal society between 1947 and 1973. If you divide up all households in the United States, or families in the United States, into quintiles, the lowest fifth, the next fifth, all the way up to the top fifth, you'll find out that the lowest fifth saw their income grow by about 116%, more than doubling, between 1947 and 73. The middle fifth, about 100%, a doubling. The top quintile, 84%. As a result, there was some narrowing in the inequality. If you go and you take a look at the next period, 1973 to 2000, roughly the same period, just the opposite happens. There is some increase in income among the lower quintile. This is real, inflation adjusted. It goes up by about 12%, 1973 to 2000. Not 12% a year, 12% over that 27-year period, 12%. The middle quintile, the median, goes up by about 27%. The top quintile goes up by 67%. In 1988, my late colleague, Bennett Harrison, who taught at MIT for many years, and I published a book, 1988, called The Great U-Turn, Corporate Restructuring and the Polarizing of America. And we were looking at these trends when many people were not. Today, since 2000, that has accelerated even further, and particularly true beginning in the 1980s and then through our last decade. The question is, why would you find such an extraordinary increase in equality which would end up making the United States among developed countries at the very top of inequality. And economists, I'm a card-carrying economist, have lots of different ideas, but many of them say, well, this is all just due to technology. We have something called skill-biased technological change, which is a fancy word for saying that those with a lot of education are getting all the rewards and those people with less education are being squeezed out of the market. And that's certainly one of the reasons. But as I looked at the data more and more, I came to the conclusion that the best way to think about this was to go back and read a murder mystery by the famous Agatha Christie. It's called Murder on the Orient Express. And the reason why that book was so important is, in her case, her great detective Hercule Poirot comes to the conclusion that a murder has taken place, and in trying to find out who did it on this train, if you remember the novel, everyone did it. There were many suspects, and they all had a role to play in the crime. Turns out we now have inequality, murder on the Inequality Express. So let me just very quickly in a few minutes give you what some of those factors are. The first is, in fact, technological change. It has biased inequality upward for the reasons I just suggested. But I come from the city of Detroit, Michigan. I grew up there. And when I was growing up in the 1950s and 60s, Detroit was not only the richest city in the United States, making it one of the richest cities in the world, it also had a very low degree of inequality. And that was because auto workers shared in the great profits of the big three, black and white. Then we came through a period of massive deindustrialization. Indeed, in 1982, I'd written a book with my friend Ben called The Deindustrialization of America and saw the decline of manufacturing, which provided very good jobs to people of modest education and skill. That disappears. The third was deregulation. We had all kinds of industries that had been paying higher wages to people of moderate education and skill that became deregulated, and many of those wage differentials began to explode, telecommunications, transportation, and so forth. We had declining unionization. Again, we know that unions, when they were much stronger and represented more than a third of the American workforce, we had much less inequality. Today, they represent less than 12%. We had downsizing of individual firms, not just in manufacturing, but in other firms, laying off people who were not able to find jobs at the wages they had before. We've had what some people have called a winner-take-all society, a winner-take-all labor market, where a small number of people at the very top of our major institutions get most of the rewards. We see that on Wall Street. We see that elsewhere. And we see it in one industry after another. Free trade itself has this effect of particularly having an impact on reducing the incomes of those at the bottom who no longer can compete with workers in China or in Mexico or somewhere else. Capital mobility. We not only have production moving abroad, we have investment moving abroad. American firms setting up operations elsewhere, taking advantage of lower wage labor and displacing people at home. Immigration itself has had this effect. We've had huge waves of immigration, probably good for the overall economy, but it has contributed to inequality as the kinds of people who are coming in are both at the very top of the income distribution, the highly skilled workers that we bring here from other countries who work in our educational institutions and our hospitals and in high tech, and those who come with very low skills, and trade deficits themselves, that our imports have exceeded our exports for so long, has really led to that kind of inequality. The reason why I talk about murder on the Inequality Express is that it suggests to me that, number one, as Richard has pointed out, inequality is an extraordinarily serious problem for countries like ours. But number two, it is caused by so many factors that to think we could find some silver bullet to fix it, that all we have to do is improve our education system, or all we have to do is do something with fair trade rather than free trade, I fear will not be enough. We need to really look at the whole panoply of suspects and find ways of working on each one of them so that we can redress the inequality we have. Thank you.
Thank you. That was much faster than an Agatha Christie book, but a much more interesting title. Now we're going to turn to Governor Molloy from Connecticut, because he's going to focus on educational policies, because he led an urban community for more than almost 15 years, Stamford, Connecticut, and has had a true focus on this in his political career. Governor Molloy, do you want to stay there, come up here?
No, I'll stay here. Okay. And listen, it's great to be with everyone. I think I was actually invited here to show that an optimist could really be depressed by two professors and very quickly. But also to share what little insight I can with government's response or complicity in what's going on. I happen to be the governor of one of the wealthiest, if not the wealthiest state in the nation, and one that has a very large discrepancy between the bottom 20% and the top 20%, and it gets worse the higher up that 20% you go very quickly. But put it in perspective, in the wealthiest state in the nation, we have three of the poorest cities in the nation in Hartford, Bridgeport, and New Haven. And quite frankly, if you ever took Yale out of New Haven, if you could subtract that, it probably is the poorest of all three cities. In the wealthiest state in the nation, one in eight children live in poverty, meaning that we have about 100,000 children in a small state of 3.5 million people living in poverty. It's really quite incredible. We know that children who grow up in poor homes are more likely than their wealthier peers to move and switch schools repeatedly, to go to school or to bed hungry, and to go without medical care with all of the additional problems that causes throughout that child's life. Not surprisingly, less than half the kids in poor communities graduate from high school on time. This is of Connecticut. And a smaller fraction ever graduate college. Nearly one in four people without a high school diploma is unemployed in Connecticut. And if you then divide along racial lines, we're talking about 50 and 60% unemployment rates on race. For even individuals who do find a job, the average wage is $10 an hour versus an affected unemployment rate for college graduates of 4.7% unemployment and an average wage of in excess of $30 an hour. So you see the consequences pretty quickly. We need to improve our educational system. We can talk about that, and I'm sure we will. I will say to you that even in the midst of this economic downturn, education probably is the area that we have to concentrate to the greatest extent on. And this is the hard part of what's going on in the United States. The vast, vast majority of states are actually cutting aid to education and doing so very substantially. And the way that's being done in most states is a withdrawal of participation funding from state government with the expectation passed on that local communities will make up the difference when, of course, those local communities are not capable of doing that. So if you actually examine how most governors resolved and legislatures resolved their budget deficits this year and last year and the year before, most of that was resolved by pushing to local government functions of state government at a time that most local governments are far more reliant on property taxes than income taxes, and it gets substantially more difficult to raise those taxes. And, by the way, it's a factor in deindustrialization because the largest taxes that many of our corporations actually pay, particularly in the state of Connecticut, but other northeastern and northern half states, is property tax. So the more we do, the more shifting, the worse it actually gets. And the ability to respond by state governments becomes more and more difficult. Education in Connecticut, we all had lunch today, and so what am I saying? Number one, we live in an anti-tax society across the board. If you look at the last elections, if you look at the forthcoming elections, it's going to be about tax policy. So in a country where we have this gigantic disparity, somehow we have convinced people who are in a shrinking and shifting middle class, that they too need to be anti-tax, even though it has the effect of making their lives more difficult. In that framework, what can government, and particularly state government, do about any of these problems? I think this is going to be the real test. I think there'll be a few progressive experiments ongoing, Massachusetts, Maryland, Connecticut, Delaware, and by and large, everyone else will follow a different course. What I think will happen is those states are going to see disparities increase even more rapidly than the states that are going to try a more progressive way of resolving some of these issues. And in point of fact, we actually live in part of the country that is somewhat more tolerant of higher tax higher taxation. But overall, what's happening in this country is we're giving up the tools to attack the problem, which has been amply described by the two prior speakers. And we are doing that on a daily basis, on a yearly basis, on an electoral cycle basis. It is really quite extraordinary. So here I am. I served for 14 years as the mayor of the city of Stamford, a very diverse city economically, but overall wealthy by national standards, where when I became mayor in 1995, greater than one-third of our students would come to kindergarten never having had a formal educative experience. Now, just think about that in relationship to everybody here who has children. Somehow, all of us, without a state-funded program, were able to guarantee that all of our children probably had 1, 2, or 3 years of pre-kindergarten learning experience. And yet, in urban areas such as Stamford, one-third in 1995, more than one-third in Hartford, New Haven, and Bridgeport in 2011 don't have that experience. In Stamford's case, those children would come to a class where two-thirds of the children had that experience. So I said this at lunch. I'll say it to you. Imagine you're a first-year teacher. You have two-thirds who know their letters, their numbers, their colors, pre-reading skills, and know how to behave in class. And you have one-third that doesn't. Which group do you spend more time on? And, of course, you should never have to answer that in the United States because we live in a country that has a national standard set almost 34 years ago as a result of a national commission that said every child should come to school in America ready to learn. And here we are. We still don't do it. And, by the way, we're giving up the tools by which we might actually do that. So we have to start thinking about this very differently. So here I am, a politician, happened to, pulled a fast one and gotten elected as governor a few months ago, and speaking to a bunch of educators at the other end of the spectrum of than early childhood education, which is my great passion. And what do we do about all of this? What does government do in this situation? What do you all do about this? And somehow, in some way, we have to defend the few tools that we have to make our society, at least on an individual experience-by-experience basis, somewhat more equal. The opportunity to reach down and educate. The opportunity to find people who we can bring up. The language we use to describe one another and our experiences has got to move to the forefront. Improvement in education, pre-K through 12, as well as our college system, private, public, four-year, two-year, has got to improve very substantially. I actually live in a state, small state, 3.5 million people, but if we examine our demographics, and we educated all of our children well, not necessarily through a four-year degree, but trained them well, educated them well, and they found the right place. If we did that well, and instead of seeing half of our children not get a timely high school degree, and 40% never receive a high school degree in some of our cities, if we took care of that problem in my little state, because of aging out demographics, I could guarantee full employment for this generation. And yet, we don't do it and haven't done it. And quite frankly, are only scratching the surface of how to do it. So we're behind the eight ball. We have to play catch up. And the first part is to certainly understand some of the causes of that difficulty. And that's what I spend my day worrying about every single day.
Thank you, Governor. Thank you very much. To tie it all up, we're going to turn to Jack McGuire. He's chairman and co-founder of McGuire Associates, who's sponsoring this event today, put it all together. And he's going to tie this all together as well to start our discussion off on this. Jack?
Thank you, Monica. And it's an honor to be on such a distinguished panel with my newfound friend, Richard Wilkinson, who is addressing to me the major issues confronting not only the first world, but as we dig even deeper over time into the second and third world countries, where these inequalities are going to become even more significant. And Barry Bluestone, my longtime friend and colleague from our Boston College days, and the governor who was actually admitted to Boston College when I was the dean of admissions there. And interesting that I thought I was going to get to introduce the governor, and I was going to make the point that he has reached the pinnacle of political success despite many, many challenges, both from within his family and his own disabilities, and also outside in a very, very difficult political environment. But I was also going to add that possibly he's reached the pinnacle of political success with the exception of maybe something happening bigger in 2016. But
you can't help yourself.
Yeah, I can't. I can't do it. My own personal background, I think I'm going to bring to bear on this brief set of comments, and then I can talk more statistics if there's interest during Q&A. But my father left school at the age of 15. I'm the first person in my family to go to college, let alone to graduate school. He was a non-believer who believed firmly in the aristocracy of effort, sent my sister and me through Catholic grammar in high schools where we worked very, very hard. He had no tolerance for the notion that stress was caused by hard work. He thought it was just the opposite and pushed us hard, which is an important part of my whole life. I ended up being elected to a school committee when I was perhaps too young in a town that was too divided and got to do collective bargaining in that town when I had to deal with both the faculties of places like Boston College and MIT and Harvard and the townies who thought that their taxes were way too high and the teachers were causing most of their grief. Exactly at that time, I came out of the physics department at Boston College by the most incredible of accidents and ended up as the dean of admissions at Boston College. And one of the first things I did as dean of admissions was to look at our data and how we admitted students to the various schools. And I was astonished to find out and actually was complicit in continuing a policy which said we need this many students in the School of Education and we are going to fill the School of Education even if we have to dig as deep as possible into the pool. And interestingly enough, sometimes we had to dig so deep that we would turn down students who are applying for the School of Education in favor of the marginally qualified students who are applying for the College of Arts and Sciences, who wanted to be doctors, who wanted to be lawyers, and in the School of Management, people who wanted to be in finance. So we tried to convince those folks that they should go into education. And I then became a trustee of the College Board and had an opportunity to look at the data, which at that time was not public. And the most astonishing thing I've discovered in probably all of the research that I've ever done is embedded in an unpublished paper, which makes it very clear that by and large, and I know I'm going to gore a few oxes in the room today, the wrong people go into education, particularly elementary and secondary education. And I don't mean because of lower test scores or because they weren't valedictorians or salutatorians. I mean on all kinds of affect measures that are self-reported that say that the teaching profession across the board over the last generation has come from disproportionately from the bottom half of high school and college classes And that's caused us to be set in a competitive disadvantage that's growing by the year. If you look at schools like Finland and South Korea and compare them, the more equal kinds of societies in Japan, and compare them with our society, they're just outstripping us in every way possible when it comes to measures in third grade or in 15-year-old measures, so particularly in STEM subjects like science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And this is having a profound impact on our entire society. Now, tie that with a couple of pieces of data. The two pieces of data are one, Larry Butler and I published that book that was mentioned, but also a paper in the Chronicle of Higher Education. We subtitled it Bringing Sand to the Beach. And if you look at one of the papers in your packet, it's by a dear friend, Tony Marks, who for many years was the president of Amherst College. Tony makes the point that there's severe inequality tying the haves and the have-nots, and we're talking mainly about institutions. Two statistics that really come to bear on the issue of teacher education. One is that the billion-dollar club, the colleges and universities in this country, the 50 or so, that control way more than half of all the endowment, somewhere close to 80 to 90% of the endowment, those colleges and universities, despite their wealth, in some cases $1 million per student in endowment, they enroll disproportionately the wealthy. So it's a regeneration. It's a cascading of wealth teaching wealth in this country, and setting people up for the next generation. And one of the reasons why this Richard's point that there's so little social mobility, there's very little mobility when it comes to the haves educating the have-nots. It's a relatively small percentage. The other item that I think is important to emphasize gets back to the cosmic question of how you compare first world countries that are rich versus poor. And one way to do that is the way that Richard does it in his book, which is a popular book. He's also written many papers that have been subject to peer review and are statistically as dense as you'd like them to be. But the ratio... or not like them to be. The ratios that he uses are the top 20% to the bottom 20%. If, in fact, you look at a more skewed ratio, which might be the top 1% to the bottom 90% or the top 1% to the bottom 20 or 30%, it's a much, much different situation, and it's grown, it's escalated, and this is where Barry's data comes in. It's grown over the years. Back in Kennedy's day, when the upper bracket taxes were much higher, and for that matter, Eisenhower and Nixon, so this isn't just a Democratic-Republican thing, when the upper brackets were 90, 80, 70%, the fact is that the top 1% who deserve to be better in terms of income than the rest of us, they worked harder, they created jobs, they're entrepreneurs, they had roughly 10% of the total. The next 9 points, which I'd call the upper class, typically have 25 points, and then the bottom 90% have the other 65. As we moved up in our day, that has shifted dramatically with the 2 to 10% folks still being at 25, and the bottom 90% having lost 15 points to the top, which means the shift has been 10% by the top 1% to 25. And all of that has happened against a backdrop of no movement to speak of in teacher salaries. Some people blame that on unions. Unions are an effect, not a cause of all of this. And it ties directly to who goes into teaching, but it also ties directly into a question, which is how respected is the teaching profession? That is, it's part of payment, part of salary, part of respect is salary, but also a lot of respect has to do with how people are treated. That takes me back to my days in collective bargaining. It takes me back to my days as a dean of admissions. It takes me back to my days as a trustee of the College Board, when College Board scores have to be calibrated for income on 20 points for every $10,000 to equalize things. And it takes me back to my days as a father who had five of his eight children, and I'll end with this, who at some point aspired to be teachers. I have one who ended up with an MBA and is now back in teaching and has two children who are doing enormously good things in teaching. And then I'll end with my favorite, and that is I have here today Terry McGuire, my daughter, who's taught in the same classroom for 27 years, and she's the world's greatest teacher and has all kinds of credentials to prove that. But the way she has done her teaching is to prove some of the axioms that Bronson Alcott, who lived in Concord and who was one of Concord's illustrious citizens, Louisa May's father, the way he built axioms for education. I asked my daughter, send me some axioms for education that you live by, and they're extraordinary how well she paints the teaching profession. What we need to do today is have more teachers like Teresa Mary McGuire, and the only way we're going to get them, unless there are extraordinary commitments like hers, is to do a better job of not, as Emerson said, seeing the secret of education as respecting the student, but now maybe seeing the secret of education as respecting the teacher. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack, and I think you thoroughly embarrassed your daughter. I was wondering, after hearing Jack talk about the wealthy teaching the wealthy and the governor speaking about early education, these are just a few of the causes, it sounds like, or the education trends that have perpetuated this social inequality. And I'm curious to hear Barry Bluestone and Richard Wilkinson chime in as well to talk about some of the education trends that have made our society so divided.
Well, I don't concentrate as much as some people would on education. The primary reason why many societies, including this, have become more unequal over recent decades is the top incomes have run away from the rest of us. That is much the most important component. And I suspect that the bonus culture, these extraordinarily high salaries at the top, reflect people at the top feeling they can do basically what they like. They don't have to answer to anyone. And that we have to respond to that by making them answerable, whether it's by having employee representatives on the board or by having more democratic economic institutions in terms of friendly societies, mutuals, cooperatives, employee-owned companies. All those kinds of companies have much smaller income differences. And the problem is that once these income differences are established so high at the top, they spread downwards. The people just below the ones at the top thinking their salaries should go up. If my boss is earning 2 million, maybe I should have 750,000. And then they move across from the private sector into the public sector. And typically, the very large companies have income differentials within them of 300, 400, 500, 600 to 1. Whereas in the public sector, it's much, much smaller, and more like 20 to 1. If you look at the military or police, it's in Britain sometimes, despite private sector having such large differences as you, in the public sector, as I say, in military and police, it's more like 7, 8, 9, 10 to 1. Quite different situation. But that those income differentials have been spreading into the private sector. So I think that these ways in which we must reduce income differences before tax, and we should be taking our customers, shoppers and so on, to companies with smaller income differences, with more democratic forms of organization.
Professor Bluestone?
Part of the problem we face is that education in our universities and colleges does a lot more than to teach people things. It creates a social network, which plays an important role in providing for those extraordinary salaries that Richard just talked about. And let me give you a very personal example. I have a son. I came to fatherhood fairly late. So I have a son who's a sophomore at a major university in this country. Not Northeastern, which I think he might have been able to get into, but Northwestern in Evanston. And I have been following his career over his first 2 years there, and I will have to tell you that given the teachers he's had at Northwestern, they're fairly good, we would have given Josh just as good an education at Northeastern. The big difference is, if you look at U.S. News and World Report, Northwestern is ranked 12th in the country, and we have moved from 162nd, Northeastern, when I first got there in 1999, to 62nd today. And we're knocking on BU's door, by the way. But that difference between 12th and 62nd, or the difference of a Harvard and a Yale, and the University of Michigan where I went, creates a social network that people draw upon that becomes very important in these winner-take-all societies. And then you begin to recognize that among all those elite schools, there has, for all intents and purposes, been no increase in their enrollment at all, so that all of the additional students who have come into the college system over the last 20 years, millions of additional students, have been generally outside that elite. And so we have this small elite, which is getting these huge incomes that pull away from everyone else. And we have the other rest of the university system given that social network. And that creates the kind of polarization. At least that's one of the reasons why we have the polarization. Like Richard, I think there are, as I said, you know, many suspects on murder and the Inequality Express. And the way we've created our education system is certainly one of them.
Well, I want to thank our panel very much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a panel discussion titled To Have and Have Not, The Growing Economic and Social Divide and Its Implications for Educational Leaders. Our speakers included British researcher and author Richard Wilkinson, Connecticut Governor Daniel Molloy, McGuire Associates Chairman and founder Jack McGuire, and the Dean of Northeastern University's School of Public Policy and Urban Affairs, Barry Bluestone. Tonight's moderator was WBUR reporter Monica Brady-Myroff. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydones. I'm Steve Brown. Thanks for joining us.